Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the whole deck of galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
All right, guys, welcome to today's show. Now, I want to start off by apologizing because I have been MIA as far as podcast episodes go. I have been sick for like almost 2 full weeks now with pneumonia, and it's getting to the point where I can actually talk without getting out of breath. I can actually get up and move around a little bit, but it's been rough. I missed my entire Ohio hunt with XOP. I was supposed to go up there with that crew. That didn't work out. I haven't been able to get out in the stand. I barely left the house or even left the bedroom. And so I'm finally to the point now where I've got the energy and I can actually catch my breath long enough to edit podcasts. So that's what I'm doing. But I'm excited about this episode. Kyle Schwalbe's on with me, and he is an optometrist and an avid hunter. He grew up in the Dakotas, moved out west, and continues to hunt and fish and do everything out west. And so this is a really awesome episode where we talk about everything from his hunts to his experiments that he's done to try to kind of understand animal vision better and how his camouflage might be best suited for a specific hunt based on an animal's eyes. So it's a very, very intriguing conversation. I think you're going to like it. Let's jump in with Kyle.
Like, he was doing things that were just badass.
That was one of the coolest moments of my life.
I was really scared, but knowing that Dan had the gun, I did have the rifle, like, we would be okay.
All right, guys, welcome to today's show. And joining me on the show today is Kyle Schwalbe. And just in the few minutes of chatting, I'm like super fired up for this because I like nerd out about weird things. And like, we've been talking about vision a little bit, but we've also been talking about all the places that you've lived and hunted. And so I'm super pumped, man. Thanks for hopping on with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, why don't you start by sharing with the listeners a little bit about yourself, maybe hunting history up to like what you do now?
Yeah, so I grew up in western North Dakota on a cattle ranch that's been in the family for a few generations. And, you know, this was back in the 80s and 90s, and we had three channels on the TV, and, you know, cartoons came on at 2 o'clock, but other than that, my brothers and I, we were out of the house. And, you know, a lot of that was, you know, our nearest neighbor was like 5 miles away. So, you know, we were out, you know, building dams and, you know, catching frogs and climbing trees and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, the outdoors, you know, it just kind of came naturally out of necessity, I guess, of being in that part of the world at that time. So, you know, as part of that, as I got older, I started trapping muskrats. We had a kind of a pond, a dam, I guess, close to the house. And my dad, you know, he grew up on the same place. And he, you know, again, big into the outdoors, hunting, fishing, trapping. And he taught me, you know, how to trap muskrats and beavers and mink and all that kind of stuff. So that was, you know, aside from shooting sparrows and stuff with my BB gun, that was really my first. I had my little trap line. I'd go out before school, you know, and it was like some of the better memories, you know, is usually, well, like October, November, and it was cold in the morning, you know, early. The bus, we lived 20 miles from town, so the bus came like 45 minutes before school started. Yeah. So I'd have to get out there and go check my traps and, you know, just that, like the frost on the grass and the thin sheet of ice on the water, you know, just talking about it, you know, it takes me back. So deep rooted in those kinds of things, you know, growing up, we were fortunate to have upland birds, pheasants and grouse and doves. I got started then, you know, into dove hunting. I had my little 20 gauge side-by-side shotgun that, you know, no recoil pad, nothing. It was, who knows, probably from the 60s.
Just brutal on the shoulder.
Oh man. For, yeah. You know, I was like, I don't even know. I was probably, I had my hunter safety card from like 1995. So I must've been 12. And, you know, I'd sit there on these water holes waiting for him to come in out of the fields and, you know, again, you know, it kind of takes me back as September, October and hot, you know, this is after school, after the 45 minute bus ride home, I'd take my shotgun out and go sit and try to get some doves. You know, and then that progressed, you know, again, to deer hunting, of course. You know, we were fortunate to have both mule deer and whitetail, on the place and you know, rifle and archery both. You know, and it just, I don't know, it's just part of who I am, I guess. And I feel very fortunate to have had those opportunities, you know, throughout my upbringing to have, you know, those people around me that could teach me those things and the opportunities that I had to, you know, get out and do it, you know, for myself. So
that's cool. I mean, I feel like when you grow up with that type of lifestyle, I mean, when you're out there with a BB gun shooting anything that moves, I mean, trapping, like that's unusual. You know, for me, trapping was never part of my upbringing. It just wasn't something we did, but the BB gun thing I can relate to. I feel like starting out as a trapper and figuring out how to get an animal into a very, very small space, that gives you a leg up on hunting almost everything. You know, you really have to know the movement of an animal in order to get them right in a precise location like that. So that's sweet. For me, it was just like, if there's a bird flying, I'm going to try to shoot it with my BB gun. If it lands on the bird feeder, you better believe I'm shooting it with the BB gun. And that was it for us. But it sounds like North Dakota is the land that you want to grow up if you want to turn into an outdoorsman.
You know, if you would have asked me as a kid, you know, like how, you know, like, it's hard to describe, I guess. Like there's a love-hate relationship there. There's all this like really awesome stuff. I look back now and, you know, I wouldn't trade those experiences for anything, but at the time, like in high school and stuff, it's like, man, you know, 20 miles to town, you know, 50 miles one way to go to Walmart, you know, it's remote and out there. But
yeah.
So at the time, you know, it didn't seem very glamorous or, you know, anything like that. But, you know, now looking back and especially with young son, it's like, man, you know, these are the times, these are the opportunities that you cannot miss because, you know, I'll be 41 here in, which is hard to believe, but 41 in at the end of October and man, it goes fast. So, you know,
yeah.
Blinking, you miss it.
Me and all my friend group are right in that range. Like I've got several friends that just hit 40. I'm a few years away from it. And in thinking about it, I'm like, how did this come up on me so quick? You know, at church, when they talk about like college groups or college age ministry, I feel like I'm right outside of that. Like I just got done with college and my wife's like, you are way past college now. And I was like, that's wild to think about. I just feel like I feel that way. My body doesn't feel that way all the time, but mentally I feel like, man, I'm just out of college, you know, like I'm a young adult. Nope. I am a middle-aged adult now.
yeah. It happens to the best of us. God willing.
Yeah, for real. So from North Dakota, I mean, you mentioned you got into deer hunting, mule deer, whitetail, archery, rifle. I mean, like kind of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
What from there? I mean, did you just kind of hone that in or did you find a new passion shortly after? Cause North Dakota, you're kind of right on that line of big, big game or just really unique Western hunts, like the big Badlands hunts or open plains hunts. What developed after you started getting into the big game side?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I've always kind of been the jack of all trades, master of none, probably.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as hunting goes, you know, so I, through high school and through college, you know, I would go home and do it. You know, I had the luxury of you know, being able to hunt deer in Western North Dakota. So I went to school on the West Coast, and it's so a professional program. You know, I mean, academic rigor was pretty intense and, you know, I tried to fish as much as I could. I, you know, fly fish and tried to fish for, steelhead. And it was primarily, my focus kind of shifted towards fly fishing just because we're, you know, out in the Cascades and the Coast Range of Oregon and Washington. And, you know, it was a little bit more accessible for one. And then the other was that I really, you know, coming from the upper Great Plains of North Dakota, don't know if you've ever been in the forest in Oregon and Washington, but man, it's different. And it takes a different
night and day
than I had to utilize. So
yeah, that would be a huge shift. I didn't really think about that. You have just like landscape as far as you can see in North Dakota, and then being so choked out. Once you get in those woods, it's wild. I've only been kind of like out and about in Northern California, Oregon, Washington one time. Mm-hmm. And once you get into that thick timber, especially the redwoods, holy cow. I could see it getting depressing, not being able to, I mean, it could be full sunlight and you can't see. It's just so thick and overgrown in there. But it's also one of my favorite places that we traveled to when we were traveling full time. The redwoods, oh man, they were magical and eerie, and it just, yeah, I felt like if I go around one of these trees, I'm going to be lost forever. It just seemed like one of those spots where, dude, you've got to have your bearings about you. Otherwise, it's going to turn bad in a hurry.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, you just hope, well, this is like pre-Onyx days, you know, and yeah, it's just, I guess, you know, frankly, I was a little intimidated by the forest out there. And you know, I guess the nice thing, so I made some, you know, exceptionally good friends that, you know, I'm friends with to this day. And this friend and I, we've hunted together, you know, quite a bit in Montana and North Dakota both. So he's a native to that part of the country. So, you know, hearing him talk about things, seeing what he did, you know, that did help, but I don't know. It just never caught on. To be honest with you, I wasn't that good at fishing out there either. I caught one steelhead, and some salmon, but, the steelhead are hard to come across.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy because typically when you think of West Coast, I mean, at least being from the Midwest, I just always imagined the beaches and being out on the ocean. But the fact that you can come inland a mile or a couple miles and immediately be in some really amazing game-rich areas, of course, with the populations out there, the tags aren't always easy to come by. There's going to be more hunting pressure. But it kind of blew me away, that area. We went out to Cannon Beach one day, mm-hmm. and holy cow, that was crazy. And then like a week or two later, I see a post of a black bear like swimming in right there, running across the beach in between everyone. And I was like, dang, this is like truly wild. You know, I never associated that growing up, but now I feel like you can't go a month without hearing about mountain lion encounter that went south in Oregon, Washington, Northern California. But yeah, that place is cool. And those Roosevelt elk are unique. They just look, I mean, obviously they're elk, but like their antler structure is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm hopeful that maybe someday, you know, I'll get back and make a little more concerted effort to hunt there, you know, for that reason. I think because of the uniqueness of the Roosevelt elk and, you know, black-tailed deer too. You know, for whatever reason, I think, you know, mule deer are what really get me kind of excited. I'm excited. Like we talked about before, I have an antelope tag this year and I'm really excited about that too. But I don't know. I just, you know, when I see, you know, if I'm just glassing or whatever, you know, you see a mule deer and my, you know, heart rate jumps a little bit. And so whether I have a tag or not, I like watching them. And there's, you know, the diversity, I think, out there of landscape you know, of wildlife is interesting too. Like you mentioned, you know, you get bears and elk on the beach, and then, you know, 150 miles to the east, you know, you get over the crest of the Cascades and suddenly it's, you know, high desert, you know, with pronghorn and mule deer and, you know, you can really, like you mentioned, tags are kind of hard to get, you know, in some units, but, you know, you can really get to some cool stuff out there. It's pretty wild. There's a lot of cool stuff to see in this country, which, I guess, you know probably better than anybody.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I feel like I've been blessed and fortunate to be on a lot of cool hunts, but I'm in the same boat as you. Jack of all trades, master of none. I like to hunt anything that's got a legal season, and I'm going to continue to pursue new opportunities. But then there's times where I'm like, man, I really want to get good at something. You know, like I want to be really proficient at whitetail hunting or elk hunting or mule deer hunting or something. And right now I just kind of dip my toe in the water on everything. And when people bring up new opportunities, I'm like, holy cow, what could I take off my plate in order to tackle a new species? Because I haven't antelope hunted. Is this going to be your first ever antelope hunt?
Yeah. Yeah. So oh,
that's cool.
Yeah. It, the unit that we were in North Dakota. So North Dakota is primarily private land. That's, you know, just the way that state is. There's a little Missouri grasslands. When you've got your own ranch to hunt on, it just doesn't register, I guess, you know, that why would I drive, you know, and, you know, go to this other place when I have it all right here. But antelope were one of those things. We're a little far north for them. And every once in a while you'd see one. I remember once we have these ranch roads, and I was riding my bike. I was probably like 15 or something. And, just riding down this ranch road, and all of a sudden there's this big old pronghorn buck standing there in the middle of the road. Scared. I didn't expect him. He didn't expect me. He took off faster than I did, but, it was, you know, they're very interesting critter.
Yeah. Are you going after it with a rifle or a bow, or is it like you can go either way?
You can go either way. Oh, sweet. Yeah. You get an archery endorsement, and then, so archery season is now. And I try to get out as much as I can, but, then, you know, come October, middle of October is when rifle season starts. And I think, I really love archery, but man, it is, I haven't figured out antelope. That is for sure. Cause they just, there's no cover, you know, it's like sagebrush that's maybe 2 feet tall and otherwise just wide open prairie. And, it seems like they tend to see you long in advance of you seeing them, and they can watch you coming. They know where to lay. They know how, it seems like they know, how to lay so that the wind and the sun and everything is to their advantage. And, you know, if you live in that environment, I guess you'd probably get pretty good at it too. So.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, I don't know what predators are out in that area, but I mean, surely coyotes and the occasional mountain lion, but bobcats. I've even seen videos of golden eagles landing on them and preying on them. And that to me seems really wild. I grew up in Wisconsin. So we had eagles, we had the occasional golden eagle, but in my mind, it wasn't until I think late high school or even college, I saw a video of a falconer who had an eagle and he was actually using it to hunt deer.
Yeah.
And at that moment I was like, that is the ultimate man card. I don't shoot deer. My eagle catches them for me. But yeah, then to think, okay, well, surely they're doing this in the wild. Otherwise, how could you train it to do that in captivity? But eagles are wild animals.
Oh man.
I love birds of prey. I don't know why I've always had an obsession with them. And golden eagles are way up there on the list. Aside from I really like falcons. I like the harpy eagle, but other than that, I think it's golden eagle.
we were driving back from Bozeman the other day, and there were a couple golden eagles on the irrigation pivot out in one of these, in these fields along the interstate. And I got really excited about that too. And my wife she's like, kind of, you know, just didn't match my enthusiasm for the situation. Yep. But they're awesome. They're, I mean, it's an impressive, they're an impressive bird, but you know, balance in all things. So there's nothing. One of my friends, he's a guide, out here that, you know, hunts some prairie, well, elk and deer and antelope, kind of on the east slope of the Crazy Mountains. And, you know, his saying is that nothing goes to waste on the prairie, and that's true, you know.
Yeah, there's just, in my mind, there's nowhere to hide, but then you see antelope or a mule deer out in the prairie and then they just vanish, and you don't understand how. For I mean, growing up in North Dakota, I'm sure you were a little more used to that, but for me, I look out and I'm like, how is there not a single animal out there right now? And what I don't realize is there's probably dozens of animals out there and I just can't see them, because they know how to use the tiniest dip in terrain to their advantage. If they don't want to be seen, they're not going to. That I do really want to get out and antelope hunt at some point, because everybody I talk to, the more people I talk to that antelope hunt are like, dude, you got to do it. It's so much fun. But from what I understand, they give you about a 300 to 400 yard window. Mm-hmm. Like, they're good if you're that far out. Any closer, they're gone. And they're running as if you just walked up on them. Not like, oh, I'm going to trot away. It just seems crazy to me. Like, you're one of the fastest land animals on the planet, and you won't let anything get closer than that to you? Like, they must not be very confident.
I guess. I don't know. Maybe that's it. They, I don't know. Well, put in for a tag, you got a place to stay here in Montana if you draw. So.
Oh, sweet, man. I appreciate that. I haven't hunted Montana yet. It's another one of those bucket list states. And it's funny because I feel like more grizzly stories come out of Montana than anywhere else these days. It seems like grizzly encounters in Montana are just through the roof the past couple of years. Whereas, like, you don't actually hear about them that often in Alaska.
Right.
I don't know if they just quit talking about it because they're like, it happens so much. It's not even news anymore. It's just every day. But yeah, Montana's had some pretty wild grizzly attacks lately.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So, you know, kind of going back to my history, my undergraduate, I have a bachelor's in zoology. So, you know, there was a time in my life where I thought a lot about these kinds of things. I still do.
Yeah.
You know, I try to carry, you know, that forward. And, you know, I think, you know, part of it probably is that Montana is, you know, has a lot more, it's popular. It's a popular place to come and hunt. Now, so I think there's a lot more people in places where bears, you know, typically would be, and you know, probably the fact that there are more bears around too, according to, you know, population studies and fish, wildlife, and parks, and yeah, but it seems like, you know, the last couple of years, you know, you definitely hear about it more. I mean, we were out hiking in the Bear Tooths, and you know, folks coming down the trail, there's a like a, you know, couple year old grizzly off the trail, and my wife is pregnant with twins right now, so we didn't push it.
Oh,
we didn't
congrats. Keep going.
Oh, thank you. So we, you know, risk benefit. We turned around, but we've come up on them. We came up. My wife and I, this was a few years ago now. We were hiking in Glacier and up the Sperry Chalet. Up to the Sperry Chalet, and we came around this corner, and well, let me back up a little bit. So we were hiking, and there's this big rock face, you know, kind of off to your left as you're hiking up the trail, and she looked up and saw this bear, you know, coming down like a, you know, one or two year old grizzly. I forget what time of year we were there. Anyway, it doesn't matter. This bear just like hauling down this rock face, and you know, kind of going parallel to us. And there's no way, you know, I don't think there's any way that it saw us. I don't know what it was running from, but it disappeared kind of over this little saddle. They're like, oh, well, all right, let's keep going. And I don't know, probably a mile or so up the trail, we came around this corner, and be darned if there wasn't Mama Grizzly, like 20 yards down the trail. And all I saw was this giant bear head and these two little like teddy bear ears. And just froze, you know, because what else are you gonna do? And I like reached back to stop her, and it kind of like it moved off the trail a little bit, and you know, like shook some pretty good sized trees on its way off the trail. Well, then we saw this cub coming down this little spine straight towards it. And we're like, oh shoot, this is not the scenario that you really want to be in.
No,
so we backed down, you know, just they weren't coming after us. We sure as heck weren't going after them. So we slowly backed down the trail, and I mean, talk about adrenaline. Like I've never had before in my life. And we hiked probably a mile and a half or so down the trail, you know, like looking over your shoulder and, you know, hand on your bear spray the whole time. And then this Australian guy comes up the trail, and I don't know, you know, I have this maybe stereotype about what I think Australians are going to be like. And this guy fits that mold. He's like Steve Irwin, just like, oh, grizzly bear, all right. And he keeps on going. It's like, oh, all right then. And then another group came up and we're like, well, we came this far. Let's keep hiking to the chalet. You know, there's enough people now where we're probably not going to get in any trouble. So we got up to the chalet. Awesome hike. If you've never done it, highly recommended. But there was a ranger, I guess, up there. And apparently this bear and her cubs are well known to the ranger. They see him there all the time. And he was saying that, you know, as long as you stick to the trail and, you know, don't like really surprise him or get between her and her cubs, you're fine. But man, it was like, we're going to get killed.
All right, guys, if you're anything like me, you have been doing some redneck engineering in order to hang your shed antlers or your cutoffs up on the wall, or maybe they didn't even make it to the wall. They're laying all over the floor, leaned up in a corner somewhere, and not being displayed the way that they should be. I've finally found an awesome solution with Rack Hub. In fact, I just got the RH2 XL and put my largest match set on it, hung it up in my man cave, and I'm telling you right now, it looks amazing. In the past, my wife's been like, we're not hanging deadheads, we are not hanging antlers, it just doesn't look good, it doesn't fit the vibe. And now that she's seen the mount from Rack Hub, she's okay with me putting them in the house. Unfortunately for her, it's a little bit too late because I officially have a man cave and a podcast studio for myself, and all of my sheds are going to be up on the wall soon. Once I tested it out and realized that it was rock solid, I went back online and ordered a 4-pack of the RH2 XLs so that I can get all of my match sets up on the wall, and I can't wait to finally display them proudly for everyone to see. If you've dealt with that same thing in the past, or maybe you're currently dealing with it, go to rackhub.com, figure out what mounting system works best for you, and make sure to use code NOMADIC for 10% off your order. If you're an avid listener of this podcast, you've probably heard me talking about Infinite Outdoors in the past. Infinite Outdoors is expanding access for hunting and fishing on private land across the country. From whitetail hunts in Missouri to waterfowl hunts in Wyoming and pheasant hunts in Colorado, they provide access to over 1 million acres of private land listings for all types of hunting and fishing. Best part is, it's incredibly easy to browse and book properties all on the Infinite Outdoors app. The app is free to download and easy to use. All you have to do is sign up and you can browse over 250 different adventures across 10 states. Download the app today and use NOMADIC15 for 15% off your membership.
Yeah, for people who live there, it's just like every day. It's just
the bear. Totally unimpressed.
You know, yeah. Just who cares? And then for people like us, you see one, no matter how close or far, you're like, okay, we're dead. Like, this is the end. And I feel like I'm getting more comfortable around bears and in bear country. But at the same time, they're just unpredictable animals. You know, you come across the wrong one at the wrong time. And, and you know, bear encounters are rare. But for a backcountry hunter, they're a lot less rare.
Right.
So I luckily haven't had any negative encounters. There have been some that have definitely startled me or scared me a little bit, But at this point, nothing's ever been like, okay, I'm in trouble. I felt it. I felt it. Looking back, I'm going, no, I really wasn't. We were good.
My brother lives in Alaska. One of my brothers lives in Alaska. And it's like bears just don't even cross his mind. You know, he goes out, he camps on beaches, out on these, you know, islands out in the sound, and you know, goes to Kodiak, and it's like, yeah, whatever. You know, he just, I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe.
I just don't think I couldn't get to that point. Like, as a dad now, being up there, my wife and I were up there, and we watched women, like, their husbands were at work or whatever. All the girls decided to go on a hike together, and, like, our friend Taylor was one of their friends. And so we're hiking up this mountain, and there's these women, and they've got, like, 5 to 10-year-old kids that are just running 200 yards up the trail in front of them. And in my mind, I'm like, this is the worst thing you could possibly do. For them, it's just everyday life.
Right.
And I didn't grow up there. So I don't think I could ever, even if I did live there, I don't think I could ever be to the point where I was comfortable with my little kid that far ahead. Now, they did have dogs. Like, the dogs were running with the kids. So that's a little bit more of a peace of mind, but my kid would be strapped with a 10 mil everywhere he went.
Here's your chest holster.
Yeah, exactly. You've got the baby Bjorn and then the chest rig right on the front of it.
See, there's an opportunity. That's probably an underutilized, there's a niche in the market there that could be exploited.
Right next to the passy, you've just got a pistol hanging there.
Yeah.
Dude, so that's exciting. You've got an antelope tag this year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you're going back to North Dakota. You'll be hunting there.
Yeah.
Cause you said it's only like 4 or 5 hours from
here. Yeah. It's about a 5-hour drive from here.
Oh, nice.
So not too bad. So easy to get there in a weekend and, you know, get a couple good hunts in and then be back to work on Monday morning. So,
yeah. So mule deer's your passion.
Mm-hmm.
What is higher up on your list, archery or rifle, or do you just like them both equally?
I don't know. I think I like them pretty equally, but for different, you know, different reasons. I think that, you know, with archery, so, you know, I've never done any tree stands. You know, I've sat in ground blinds. I've never got anything out of a ground blind, but, you know, a lot of it has been stalking. And I get, you know, a rush out of that, you know, just trying to, you know, I mean, it's like playing hide and seek as a kid, you know, when you're hiding and like somebody's close and you know, kind of got to pee a little bit because you know that they're like going to get you. That's kind of the feeling that I get when I, you know, take my bow out and try to sneak up on something. And I usually don't have to pee that bad in this part, you know, in this part of my life. But, you know, it's that same kind of like, you know, I don't know if it's enthusiasm, excitement, anticipation, you know, it just takes all these, you know, different kind of feelings and emotions and wraps it all into one, you know, for me. And I think probably part of that too has to do with just the time of year that, you know, the season goes on. You know, there's something that I love equally about walking around in the snow and, you know, glassing and, you know, being like just freezing your butt off out there and wind. And like, it's that kind of type 2 fun where it really sucks at the time.
Yep.
Like, what am I doing this for? And then you look back and, you know, you just can't help but smile about it. And, you know, like, observing the deer, you know, in the rut, you know, during rifle season in North Dakota is, you know, that's one of my favorite things. And here too, I mean, I was out the other day, you know, driving around scouting for antelope and there were little, you know, little bucks sparring with each other. And I don't know, it's just a very cool, I guess more than anything, probably, I like animals and I feel like hunting, you know, gets me, you know, rather than just hiking or photography or whatever, you know, you become a really, you take a really active role in that ecosystem, you know, when you're out there. Yeah. So, you know, you have the power to, you know, remove an animal from it, or, you know, it's a really, it's kind of a humbling sort of nature to it, I think, that I enjoy. That's, you know, and it's not, I guess, always about, you know, harvesting an animal or something, but man, I just really like being out there. I think that's, you know, harvesting something is icing on the cake for me, but, yeah, being out watching them and just being a part of it, taking that active role is what, you know, what I really like.
Yeah. I say it all the time. You become an active participant instead of just a spectator. Mm-hmm. And you are part of the circle of life, the food chain, whatever you want to say, when you go out there in their environment, and there's nothing that I've found that's like it. You know, it's a rush. It is, there's a calmness and a chaos to it, and I can't get past it. I think about it all the time. I mean, I'm sure people are super passionate about other things also, but I'm like, it's an obsession. It really is, to just be out there. If I'm in the backyard and there's a squirrel, I'm not shooting it, but I'm going to try to get close. Like, I'm going to spot and stalk a squirrel just because it's fun. Yeah. And I do that with everything. And I like to see my kids getting excited about that stuff too. You know, when you have a passion and your kids see it, they're just getting fired up lately about it. They're catching anything that moves. They want a fish. So we bought a house. It came with a koi pond, and there is like a 2-foot koi. He's at least 2 feet. We still haven't named him, but he's this giant, giant koi. And the kids are like, can we catch him? I'm like, no, you can't catch him. Like, I like that you're thinking about catching him, but I don't know how old koi get, but this thing is huge. And I'm like, no, we probably should just leave him alone. But if it's a frog, if it's anything and everything, they want to catch it. And I love that they're fired up about it, because that's how I was as a kid. Like, my kids are growing up way more urbanized than I did. Yeah. You know, it, for me, same thing. We didn't have video games. We got a Super Nintendo at some point, and my mom's like, no, you're not playing that. And we would play, we had 3 games for it. We had, what was it? We had Super Mario Bros. We had The Lion King, and we had one other that we must not have played. Oh, Aladdin. And so we had like those 3 games, but you could, after we beat it once, you could beat the whole game in like 45 minutes. And right. So it wasn't that exciting. So we get a BB gun. We're shooting anything that moves, including each other sometimes, which I don't recommend. Yeah. But we're just out shooting. Or back then, we would take our bikes, me and my brother, as little kids. We would ride our bikes a mile into town. And by town, I mean a town of 300 people. And, you know, we'd go get a 1-penny Tootsie Rolls, or we'd pay 75 cents for a little Daisy carton of new Copperhead carton of BBs for our BB gun. It was just, everything just seemed more simple and more adventurous. And with the kids now, I tell them all the time, I'm like, no, you're playing outside. No, you're not getting on your iPad today. No, you're not playing any video game. Like, just go outside and do something. And they do. They go out and catch stuff. And I just, for me, my wife really wanted to be close to friends, which I'm totally fine with. Mm-hmm. We do have 3 acres, but it's not the same. It's not like they can just go down to the creek and play in the creek, or, you know, go build a tree fort. It's different. Yeah. I don't know how to get back to that, but also I understand not everyone's going to grow up the same way.
Yeah.
So they'll have to figure out their passions a little bit different than I did.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think that's a valuable perspective, and, you know, supporting, I'm, you know, trying to take the mindset, and our son is young yet, so trying to take the mindset of supporting him and whatever kind of little, you know, whatever, I shouldn't say little, I mean, it's important to him. So, you know, whatever things he finds interesting, and, you know, built a sandbox in the backyard. You know, like we live at some, a little bit of elevation, and I can see down kind of into the valley a little bit. And, there are two cornfields and a hay field. And in the morning there's a white-tailed doe and a couple fawns that come out of the, well, they're in the hay field when we, you know, kind of get over when it gets light, and then they move, you know, usually off into the cornfield. But I stand there with my binoculars, and I kind of wonder sometimes what my neighbors think I'm looking at, but like, but you know, my son, you know, he's interested. He wants to look too. And, you know, I take him out, we drive around and, you know, look for stuff out on the, you know, out on the back roads. And he, has his own little toy binoculars, and, you know, he's just, we got pictures of him sitting there in his car seat with his little binoculars, just looking out the window. And I mean, you know, those kinds of experiences I hope will be formative, you know, for him, and, you know, develop a curiosity that allows him to find whatever passion he has. So, you know, hopefully it's outdoor kind of stuff, because that would be cool, but, you know, we'll see.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
Did you grow up shining deer? Was that a thing in North Dakota? Like, did you go out at night and spotlight and just like look for eyes? And I mean, I'm not saying hunting. Don't misinterpret. We didn't go around shooting deer, but like that was a thing. And I don't know a lot of people aside from like the Great Lakes areas that grew up doing that. And when I tell my hunting buddies about it, they're like, "Wait, you did what?" And if you go out at night to a cornfield or a field that's cut or a creek bottom, and you just shine a spotlight and you look for deer, and they're like, "What are you talking about? Was that a thing in North Dakota? Did you guys ever do that?"
No, we never did that. We just tried to avoid hitting them on the highway, but that was about it.
That's funny. Yeah, that was like one of our favorite things to do as kids when my dad was home from like driving. He was an over-the-road truck driver, and so when he was home, it was like, "Can we go shining?" And he's like, "Yeah, let's go." So we would go out, and I mean, at night, especially in a freshly cut field, you might see 50, 60 deer out in this field.
Oh, sure.
And so then you're looking for antlers, but it seemed like any clearing in Wisconsin had a set of eyes looking back at you. But yeah, that was the thing, and I think here it's illegal. I haven't really looked into it much, but they had pretty strict rules about it. Like, you couldn't have any firearm on you. You couldn't even have loose ammo in your vehicle. You couldn't have a bow. I mean, anything that you could possibly shoot a deer with, you could not have with you. But we just would drive around in a spotlight, and it was the greatest thing. I want to go. Like, now that I'm thinking about it, it's dark here. I'm like, I kind of want to go do it. That sounds like a lot of fun.
I fully support that. I think you should. You got to bring that back.
Yeah, bring spotlighting back. I'm all about that. So
we never did that, but like, you know, you'd be driving down the road and see, you know, what might be a big buck in the ditch at night, and you'd, you know, we called it whipping a shitty.
Yeah.
Turn around and go look and see how big it was, and that was about, you know, just there in the headlights, and that was about it. But we didn't spotlight him. That'd be fun. I'll just mention it.
I feel like it probably started as that. Like, people would see deer in a field, and it was very common to see someone's car turn like 40 degrees or 45 degrees into a field. And so then you're like, "Oh, what do they see?" You know, and so you pull up and you want to see it. So then you do the same thing. They're trying to get off the road and out of the way. And then you pull up and you do it, and I'm assuming at some point someone goes, "We need to just get spotlights for our cars. This would be way easier." And so we would. I mean, it looked like a rave going down the back roads, because we would have multiple spotlights, and they make crazy spotlights. They make like 10 million candle power spotlights now.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is we could never find one that lasted very long. Like, they all would burn out way too quickly. But it's like, some of us had little flashlights, some of us had mag lights, somebody had a spotlight. We would all want to take turns. But we're just driving down a country road, and I can only imagine an aerial view of that, just lights panning in every direction off of the vehicle.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, we had We had these old, probably from the 70s or 80s, but these big flashlights with those, I don't even know how many volts they were, but like these probably 9 or 12 volt, like Duracell batteries with the spring prongs on top.
Yep.
We used them to check, like when we were calving in the springtime, we'd use those to go out at night and check the cows to, you know, make sure nobody's having trouble or whatever. I didn't think to repurpose it for that. That's, just not innovative enough. That's my problem.
You gotta go try it, man. Everyone needs to go to Wisconsin and spotlight at some point. Just do it in a county that's away from where I hunt, and we're all
good. Well, you know, it's interesting, the deer reflection, the eye reflection that you get.
Yeah.
So, deer have a special layer underneath their retina called the tapetum lucidum that is really reflective. And, you know, when you get like camera flash in humans, that's red, that's because your retina is mostly red. But these deer have the special membrane, and other animals have it too. The idea there is that, it is really hyper reflective. So it helps them see better in really low light conditions because they're able to utilize more of whatever ambient light is available. Because it bounces around rather than getting absorbed. So there's your eye trick for the day.
That's cool. That's really cool. I just imagined that every animal's eyes glowed. And I saw a post one day about different colors and like what different animals have different colors. And then when we were in Alaska, we were driving and my buddy Austin was like, "Hey, just so you know, moose eyes don't glow. Like they're not reflective." And I was like, "Nah, that's not right." And he's like, "No, I'm pretty sure it's right." And then he kind of started second guessing it. And for the most part, I didn't see their eyes glow when we were driving to and from our hunting spot. We did see it on one of them. And so then I was like, I knew it, debunked. But as a whole, like a deer, you can see that from a mile away, it seems like. Whereas on a moose, like it wasn't super obvious. And I'm like, that's the worst animal to not have super reflective eyes. Like I feel like their antlers should reflect because they're just so big. And that can be catastrophic if you hit one of those. Oh. We saw...
For sure.
On the final day, we were heading back to the airport after our hunt, and there was a truck that was, destroyed in a dead cow moose right in front of it. And I'm like, I can't imagine. That would just, that would be a wreck. We've hit so many deer growing up, and a moose, though, you know, you're talking something that weighs 8 to 10 times more.
Right.
And its belly, on the... One of our rental cars was an F-250, and the belly on some of these cows was at hood height on this F-250.
They are huge, huge critters, especially up there, man. They are, my brother lives in Anchorage, and, I don't know what we were doing, just hanging out at his house, looked out the window, and there was a cow moose and her calf just standing in his front yard, and, like, I'm 6'3", and I bet, at the shoulder, she was taller than I am. I'm pretty sure of it. So, yeah, they're
just monsters.
Yeah, but I agree with you. So I lived in Anchorage for a while during one of my clinical rotations, and I traveled between Anchorage and a clinic in Wasilla, and I was there in the middle of winter, from like November to February, so it was dark all the time. And there, were routinely moose on that road, past, Eagle River and the Air Force Base up there. And it is dark, and you cannot see them. And they come right through your windshield.
They just blend in. So you went up there for rotation. You're an optometrist now. Mm-hmm. Okay. So before we dive into the eye stuff, I've got a joke for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many eye doctors does it take to screw in a light bulb?
One or two?
Is it one or two? One or two? I told my eye doctor that. He didn't think it was that. He had probably heard it a bunch. But
I love a good joke. I'm not good at telling them, but man, that's a good, I'll give you that. That's a good one.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Now, so I'm curious about what you found. I mean, the crossover, obviously, most hunters in the West, even here, like in the Midwest, are using optics. Mm-hmm. Optics, I feel like, are getting better and better. But with you studying the eye and like the effects of the eye and how, I mean, there's got to be some crazy benefits to knowing more about your eyes, especially when everybody's hunting with their eyes first and foremost. You know, right. Like if you can't see the game, how are you going to shoot the game type of thing?
Right.
So I'm kind of curious about this because you had mentioned before the show, it doesn't really matter if you have these super, super expensive optics, the best optics out there. If your eyes aren't right, like it's not really going to be that beneficial to you. Yeah. And then to also understand how to use those optics, because eye fatigue, I didn't know anything about eye fatigue until my first elk hunt. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this sucks. This is the worst. I had a headache. It just felt like I was getting a cold. And yeah. My buddy's like, dude, you got to back off the binos for a little while. And yeah. I was using super cheap binos and I couldn't, it just didn't seem like anything could focus. My eyes were constant. It was a workout for my eyes the whole time I was out there.
Yeah. Well, you know, so to your point, like 80% of our sensory information is visual. So, you know, most of the way that we interact with our world is based on what we can and see and how we interpret what we see. And, you know, I mean, that extends to, you know, hunting, certainly. So, yeah, I mean, I feel, you know, I guess this isn't the reason that I got into this at all. It's just like, you know, I have this, you know, I have this set of skills and, you know, it so happened, I guess, that just, you know, kind of maybe the way that I talk to people or whatever, like, or the things that I'd bring up or mention, or I just ask, I guess I'm curious about people generally. So we get into conversations, you know, me and my patients about like the things that they like to do. And, you know, I started to see more and more hunters over the years and not just hunters, but people that, you know, are into bird watching and that kind of stuff. We had a big wildlife refuge just down the road from, where we used to live. And, I mean, like, people would come from all over the world to see these, you know, weird West Coast, you know, Pacific flyway kind of birds. And,
yeah.
And, so there's like a center of gravity, I think, for that kind of, you know, people that would probably be using, you know, these optics. And we got to talking about, you know, how vision, you know, interrelates and, you know, how the eye works. And, you know, I mean, to be clear, I'm not a optical engineer by any means, but, you know, I feel like I've got a fairly deep understanding in how, you know, the human eye works and by extension, how other mammalian eyes work. You know, and in that, I hope that, you know, it gives some kind of advantage, at least a better understanding of, you know, how to best utilize optics as a tool and, you know, how to use your vision most effectively. And also like what deer see. I think that's really, you know, kind of, I don't know about elk, but there's a lot of good studies. I forget the scientists out of, they're at the University of Georgia. But they've done some work, about, you know, kind of trying to figure out what do deer see. And that's kind of captured my interest, here lately. I in one of the closets in the basement. So I was reading one of these studies. And I got to thinking, like, I wonder, you know, so there's all these different camo patterns. I'm kind of a mix and match guy. And I think I've heard you, you know, talk on the podcast before about, like, you know, camo from a thrift store and that kind of stuff. And,
oh yeah,
you know, and I don't know, I get most of mine on sale. You know, I just kind of, I'm not beholden to any brand. It's like, oh yeah, this, you know, this is what I need. I'm going to grab it and see how it works. And never really giving much thought to, yeah, this is the camo pattern. It's going to break my silhouette. You know, like I get that. But their research indicates that deer, they have, their visual sensitivity is biased pretty heavily towards the blue end of the spectrum. So humans, they see something different than, you know, deer see something different than we see. Yeah. So we're trichromats. We've got three photopigments, a red, a green, and a blue. Deer have a blue and kind of a green. So basically they're red, green, colorblind. But they see much better into the short wavelength blue and even supposedly into the UV end of the spectrum where we can't really see. So I went on Amazon naturally and bought a blue flashlight. I don't know. This is a very poor man's experiment. I bought a blue flashlight and a UV flashlight for like, you know, $8 a piece or whatever. Hung all my stuff on the closet rail downstairs, closed the door, turned off the lights and shined my blue light, my UV light at it. And be darned if it didn't reflect. Like some things reflect a lot more blue than others. Some rests like under UV. I have an older Sitka jacket. I have no affiliation in any of these companies. But the zippers just light up like under a black light. It's the craziest thing. I had no idea. And you never know by looking at it.
Yeah.
I have some wool. So, you know, I elk hunt in Montana and it's, you know, oftentimes very cold. So I found wool is, you know, kind of the best outwear, it seems, especially wool pants. But they too, I don't know if there's some synthetic fibers in there or what, but they reflect quite a bit of blue, and some UV, fluorescence also. Kuyu is pretty good. I have a Kuyu rain jacket. I have a Kryptek puffy, and the material is fine, but you can see the insulation in the, you know, like the little pillow, puffy insulation, it fluoresces through it. So it just glows under UV light. I have,
we're out here walking around looking like glow sticks to deer and we have no idea.
Maybe,
no.
You know,
yeah. So. I mean, who knows? I mean, you're shining a light on it and it's, you know, it's reflecting more, but that's really interesting. Now I'm curious. So you said they're red, green, color blind. Mm-hmm. I know everyone's got, we've got headlamps that have the red light on it.
Mm-hmm.
What do they see if you have a red light on? Do they just not see anything? Or surely it still has to illuminate and they're catching some of that?
Yeah, so that is a good question. And I think, so I thought a lot about this because I've spent a lot of time walking across the prairie in the pitch dark with my red light on trying to not step in badger holes. And I do, I think you're right. I think that they probably do sense something, but I don't think what they sense is as bright relative to like a white light. You know, like if you have your headlamp on the bright setting, I think, you know, I mean, obviously they'd see that. It contains all the colors of the spectrum, you know, blue included. Plus, you know, there's a fair amount of intensity there, but with the red light, being as you're filtering out the longer wavelengths, and they are not sensitive to that anyway. My guess is that there probably are, you know, a few photons of other wavelengths that get out of that filter and you know, they probably sense some luminance, but I'm thinking it's probably pretty muted compared to, you know, to the white light. So I do it. The tricky thing is you can't ask them what they see, you know,
and
designing a good experiment to really test that is pretty hard. I'm no PhD like these folks at George are, but, I expect that, it would be difficult to test, but theoretically I think it's better than a white light.
All right, guys, I've got to tell you about some of the new XOP products that I've been using this fall. And some of them I use in kind of an unconventional way. First off, I use the Mondo saddle, but I also use their turkey hunter vest. And I take the Cold World stand, put it in the back of the vest, and carry it in that way. Depending on how far I have to pack in,
I'll just bring a foot platform. But one thing I've learned is that if I put the seat cushion on the underside of the seat and flip it up, it turns it into a knee pad also, or I can flip the seat down and sit on it like a conventional tree stand. I also used their holster kit clipped right onto my saddle to carry in my climbing sticks while keeping my hands free. If you're interested in getting a mobile hunting setup like mine, go to xopoutdoors.com and use code NOMADIC for 10% off at checkout. All right, how many of you guys hate dealing with tangled up rope? Trying to untie it, it's all knotted up, and you actually really need it at the time. Don't raise your hands because I obviously can't see you, but those days are long gone. Rapid Rope is a quick deploy rope solution that you can pull the length you need and cut it all with one hand. You don't need knives or scissors or a lighter to singe the end because it's cross-threaded to keep it from fraying. Yeah, they've thought of everything. And this is way stronger than your average 550 cord. In fact, this is 1,100 pound test. It comes in a shatterproof canister that you can fit in the cup holder in your vehicle or your backpack, or I don't know if you still wear cargo pants, any one of the 1,000 pockets that you have. It comes in a 120 foot canister, a 70 foot canister, and you can get a rope refill. So just in a matter of seconds, you could be deploying and cutting rope with one hand again. So if you want to stop dealing with the headache of untying rope and detangling everything anytime you need to tie something down, go check out rapidrope.com and use code NOMADIC for 10% off at checkout. I've never really thought about the camo. In fact, I hear companies, they come out with stuff and they're like, scientifically proven, you know, this and that. And I'm like, but how? Like, how do you really prove that? And it's interesting to hear from someone who has studied the eye and gone to school and really figured a lot of this stuff out that, like, no, there's, I mean, if they're seeing on the blue spectrum a lot more, and I've heard that, I've heard like blue jeans, which is funny because I know a lot of people growing up in Wisconsin who used to wear blue jeans. I mean, that's like, if it was a warm day, I'm hunting in blue jeans and a flannel. Like, that's it. And obviously, you know, if they look your direction, where we're hunting, you're also not wide out, wide open in a field, not super up close and personal a lot of the times. Like, they're preoccupied on a different level on a hill. But knowing that, like, they actually do see some of these colors better, and especially if they're, you know, diving into like the IR spectrum, I just, that it's pretty wild in my mind. I'm like, oh, they can't see any of this stuff. But then I get a trail camera and it's got an IR flash on it. And for the first couple weeks of my trail cameras being out there, I mean, they are staring straight at it. And I'm like, well, they definitely know, maybe it makes a noise. And I'm like, surely it's got to make a noise. No, they're definitely seeing it and getting spooked by it. And it's not until they get used to it and condition that they don't really care that much anymore.
Yeah, you know, I think it'd be interesting. Now, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, how you could test that. And you could theoretically, you know, get like a blue filter, you know, at those really short, like 480, you know, 500-ish nanometer wavelengths, and go out there at night, hold up your filter and see what you see, because it would block out, you know, the other shorter end of the spectrum, the reds and the greens that we, human sensitivity peaks at kind of this green yellow, like 550 nanometers. We're better at red. So green is best, red is second, blue is worst for us. And, in terms of visual sensitivity, but they all kind of mix together and our brain, you know, does some interesting things when it processes it. But, you know, using a filter, you could, I guess, block out those shorter wavelengths that are the peak of our sensitivity. And that might give you a better idea of what, you know, if, like, if there is some light source that you don't perceive otherwise, you know, you might be able to pick that up. I don't know. You know, I guess we'd have to experiment a little bit. So,
yeah. I like your experiment, though. I know you said this is just kind of like a poor man's experiment. It's brilliant. I would have never thought to do something like that. But
I don't know how applicable. You know, we'll see how. I there's more work to be done. I'll say that. I have a blue pair of Wranglers, naturally, And I hung those up, and you know, as you'd expect, they don't fluoresce with the UV, but man, they reflect a fair amount of blue. That being said, my dad, you know, the only thing that he hunted in ever was either ratty old Carhartt coveralls that were just caked, you know, in manure, or blue jeans if it was warm enough. And
yep,
you know, I kind of got to thinking about that too, because you know, like a pretty good deal of visual perception is neurological. So your brain, you know, does a lot to predict, or it kind of fills in the gaps based on previous experience. And it's really, I'm not doing a great job of explaining it, but there's a lot of prediction involved in your visual experience. You know, like the story I like to tell, my wife, she's from the Northeast, and we were out hiking in New Hampshire. And there was this tree bent over, like broken off, about, you know, 8 feet off the ground. And it was kind of, you know, like a, I don't know what pitch it would have been, but it looked like a roof pitch for a lean-to. And she thought, yeah, it was an outhouse. And, you know, like that kind of, you know, her brain recognizing that this angle and this height, you know, likely represents something that you have previously seen, rather than what it actually is, which is this broken off tree, you know, is really fascinating. And I think that, you know, probably, like, I've made this argument before to one of my friends that, you know, like if you're hunting the ranch in North Dakota around the house, wear blue jeans, wear cowboy boots and a hoodie, and that's what the deer are used to seeing. Like, cognitively, yeah, I would expect that, you know, this is not going to raise any alarm bells because that's how my dad walks around. And, you know, so there's a certain, I think, behavioral aspect to it too. Obviously that doesn't apply, you know, when you're out, you know, in wild, you know, in more wild country. But, you know, again, you can't ask deer what they think or see, but, yeah, you know, behaviorally, I think it, you know, makes sense that you could extrapolate that to, you know, being like them predicting, is this a threat? Is this not a threat? Based on my previous experience, this is what I know about the situation when this shows up. So, you know, it's an interesting kind of psychological experiment that, you know, I don't know how that would play out in a real scientific way, but something to think about.
No, I like that idea that, I mean, they're housing they're storing past experiences, and maybe they're not like recalling them, but it becomes instinctual. And for me, I've seen it over and over again where if I'm just walking around, I've had deer that have just stood there and looked at me.
Yeah.
I'm walking around just doing my thing or like checking trail cameras and it's not season. And then as soon as I start moving slow, start creeping around, I've heard stories of like really, really successful whitetail hunters that will almost jog into the woods. Yeah, and they're like, completely. For real, like they'll jog into their tree stand, climb up their tree, and then let everything settle down. And they're like, think about it. And I'm sure I've said it on the podcast before, but think about like at your house, you see somebody walking down the sidewalk or jogging down the sidewalk or down the street. You don't think anything of it. You see somebody walking real slow and they keep looking side to side. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, that's off. Like,
right.
There's something suspicious. And then you think of how predators work and how they move, and they're doing that type of movement. And for me, yeah, I would raise a red flag. Like if I saw a bear just kind of like walking around eating berries, wouldn't think anything of it. If it's creeping real slow and like looking my direction, okay, now I've got something to be worried about. And I guarantee that although it might not be, it might not be something they're breaking down like that in their own mind, like it's definitely firing off different alarms for them when we just creep around like that. And then I've also thought about it in the waterfowl world, because I've seen so many, like you go to a city pond, you go to a golf course, there's birds everywhere. I mean, they're just like, you could literally go and beat one to death with a golf club. And then you're out at a pond in the middle of nowhere, maybe a cornfield a half mile away, and you can't get within 200 yards of that thing without all the birds taking off. Right. And I keep thinking, I might just make some like fake little houses, put like little little tykes houses out by my hunting pond and watch the birds just bomb in thinking it's a park. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I think it would actually work. I kind of want to try it. I haven't done it yet, but I really want to try it and be so obvious that there's human activity there and see how the birds react. Start waterfowl hunting in running shorts. You know, like it might work.
I think there's probably more to that than we give it credit for, you know? And like around here, I take the dog out trail running, and there are, you know, we've got some urban bucks, and like they just do not care. I jog past them with our, you know, 110 pound dog, and they just stand there, you know, they not a care in the world. And you know, they get, I guess, habituated to those kinds of things. So, but you know, thinking about like buffalo plaid, you know, the red and black checker, you know, like I've heard that described as the first camouflage. And, you know, now if you think about that, you know, being red and darkly colored, and then having that repeating pattern, you know, to break your silhouette, I don't see why that wouldn't work, you know, like,
yeah.
So I don't know. There's more to this story, I think, but, I think so too. I have all my stuff hanging up in my closet, and maybe at some point down the road where I actually learn something, we can do episode 2 and really dive deep into that kind of stuff. But it's been really interesting, and, you know, get a cheap, little UV flashlight, on Amazon and check out your clothes. I mean, you'd be surprised. I have an Under Armour jacket that is good, but there's like a thing of tree sap, like pine tree sap on the sleeve from, you know, leaning up against a tree, and that just fluoresces. It's crazy. Like, I mean, fluorescence is different than reflectance, but, you know, it stands to reason that if it's fluorescing, you know, that means that those wavelengths are getting emitted. So it's like, I guess backing up a little bit, it's like with a blue light, you know, or a black light rather. So the black light shines out this, you know, UVA wavelength, and it hits, you know, paint or whatever, and the paint absorbs it and then emits a different wavelength. That's what fluorescence is. And that's why, you know, black light can turn into green or pink or whatever. And that's the same kind of thing, like with the zipper or with the with that tree sap. You know, it's absorbing those UVA. Well, most likely, who knows? It's a cheap flashlight, so who really knows what wavelength it is? But and then emitting a different wavelength, and you know, so it tells me there's something. You know, there's something going on there that may be applicable to, you know, the kinds of things that we like to do. You know, granted, the real world is different, but it's I don't know. It's interesting.
Man, this has me just thinking like crazy about all of my clothing and wanting to know what animals are seeing. Because I think I really do, like with turkey, like what are they seeing? With coyotes when I go out hunting, what are they seeing? And then you just – for deer, I never really put a ton of thought into it because I'm like, I'm sitting in a tree – in an entire blaze orange jumpsuit. Like, I couldn't be more obvious, but now it makes sense. Like, how are all these people killing whitetail during rifle season? Well, it's because they're red, green, colorblind. They don't see that color. You know, you're just kind of blending in. And it always made me laugh to see the breakup, like the black breakup on a blaze orange jacket. And I'm like, you guys are the dumbest people. And turns out I'm the idiot who doesn't understand vision at all.
I have that experience commonly. I'm right there with you. But they probably see blaze orange as, you know, some sort of a kind of a probably a brown, I suppose. You know, brown tan kind of shade, I would guess. You know, assuming their color vision works like humans do, but yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And the studies from, the University of Georgia, they talk about it. So the reason, I think part of the reason that they study deer is because, you know, there are a lot of captive whitetail, you know, probably, I know there are captive coyotes, of course, but like, you know, I don't know, nobody's done any studies on that yet, but yeah, I mean, it's visual perception is really kind of fascinating. And, you know, that I think goes to say too, like, you know, for you and me, who's to say that what I perceive as a certain color is the exact same thing as what you perceive. And it's probably a little bit off for various reasons. You know, we just associate, it's our subjective association with that objective color that we, you know, that's that our mental assignment of what red looks like or what blue looks like. And it could be different for other people or different hues or saturations. And you don't really know. That's what makes vision kind of, you know, fascinating.
Yeah, man, that's so wild to think about. I've heard people say that, like, do you think green looks the same to me as it does to you? And I'm like, don't do that to my brain right now. Like, I just can't handle that. I am kind of curious though, how far away do you think we are from actually being able to essentially plug into an eyeball? I mean, like, use an eyeball from a deer and somehow connect to it and actually see what they're seeing as if it were a camera lens and you're collecting data through it. Do you think that's coming? Because it seems like technology and biology, they're just getting so much closer together in this Neuralink stuff that's happening. I'm just curious your take on that. Do you think we'll be to that point soon, or do you think that's, you know, never going to happen?
No, I think that's a really good question. And, you know, there have been some studies and devices built for humans that have gone blind for whatever reason to, you know, try to restore vision. Like we talked about, 80% of your sensory information is visual. So, you know, there's a lot of incentive to help folks that, you know, have lost vision for whatever reason. And, there are some methods that, you know, whether it's through like a camera setup on a pair of glasses, that can kind of translate the visual image into another stimulus. So there's a device that had like a little, like a flat sucker sort of looking thing. So you put it on your tongue and it would, I think it used electricity to, like, you know, sort of like if you saw a square, it would emit electricity in a way that, you know, it would activate the sensors on your tongue so that, like, when you lick a battery or something to see if there's still charge, that it would, you could see by this electrical stimulation on your tongue, you know, a square. To really plug in, so like Neuralink, for instance, you know, to like see what something else sees, you know, I think there's potential there. I don't think it's probably close. I think that, so there are like 20 million nerve cells that run through your optic nerve. Dang. And each of those is associated with a certain area of your retina, so that every area of your retina is mapped in the occipital cortex of your brain, so back here, and that's where your visual processing happens. And like in a disease like glaucoma, for instance, where damage happens to the optic nerve, you know, eventually, if enough damage happens, it interrupts the signal between your retina and your brain, so it causes you to, you know, lose visual sensitivity in the peripheral part of your retina. And it's your brain or the peripheral part of your vision, your retina works and your brain works, but the optic nerve doesn't work. And it's the connections and that retinal mapping and the visual cortex mapping that I think are kind of the really, they're the really difficult sticking point. Because of the, just the massive amount of integration it takes to process vision. So yeah, you could hook
an
eyeball up to some kind of device, you know, and you could potentially, you know, excite it with light of different wavelengths or whatever, and that would emit a signal. And we have that technology now. That's something we do clinically, in what's called an ERG to kind of test the retina basically. But, you know, to really interpret then, like, what meaning does this have? You know, what meaning does this nerve signal have? That is the wild card. And I, you know, that there are people a lot more intelligent than I am that, you know, could probably figure that out, but, or, you know, groups of people, but yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably a little ways off yet, but man, it would be really interesting.
That would be so wild. And then I think, like, okay, but what are you actually going to do with that? You know, like, you can plug into an eye and it's like, now we see what they see. Or you could just wear a camera on the side of your head. And you know, I'm like, what application? Obviously, for the scientific purpose, amazing. For the medical purposes, amazing. But then it's like, that's so much money and time and development and technology. And then it's like, what, you have to have a reason to be doing it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, just to see through the eyes of something else, unless they're studying something very specifically, nobody's going to dump billions into that. Or maybe they are.
Maybe.
Maybe they're doing it right now.
I don't know. I don't know. They don't, the powers that be don't tell me those secrets. But the other side of that is, you know, do you really want to know? Like, would that ruin it? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I do kind of want to know, like, when I'm standing up in my tree stand, what is that deer actually seeing? Because I've had it. I mean, they do. I've had so many deer just stare straight at me and then just go right back to eating. And I'm like, what does it see? Because if I was in the woods and I looked right up there, I'd be like, dude, there's a hunter staring at me. And I see, it looks like he's got the bow drawn back. Obviously, they're not processing all that. It's just kind of like, is something off? They're using their intuition, I feel like, more than anything. Yeah. And it's like, is something off? Do I need to run? No. Okay, I can go back to feeding. But for me, dude, if I saw something crazy like that in a tree, I'd be out of there.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if, like we were talking about the behavioral aspects, you know, they probably aren't really used to getting, you know, to seeing predators that high up in a tree, or, you know, danger that high up in a tree. Yeah. So maybe it just doesn't register based on their previous experience that this is something that we really need to worry about. Of course, then, you know, there are others that just take off. So I don't know. That's a really interesting question.
I think deer on public land in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, they're probably pretty conditioned to looking up in trees. That's but true. Yeah, I think most other places, like, they hear, sure, they're going to be directed that way if they hear a sound or something or catch movement. But yeah, as a whole, like, what in the wild? There you go. Golden eagles. Yeah. Golden eagles ruined it for all of us.
Thanks a lot. You're
going to start staring up in trees. Dude, I feel terrible because we're already at like an hour and 20 minutes, but it feels like it's just flown by. And I feel like we could keep talking about this because now I'm really kind of getting fascinated. I understand why you got into the whole eye world, because this is really intriguing. Like, starting to think about, I've never thought so much about eyes in my life. And now I'm kind of like, I want to do some experiments and find out what my clothes look like to a deer and a turkey and a duck.
I encourage it. I think that there's some value in that. I mean, like I said, it is really fascinating. There are books written on, you know, human visual perception. It's easier to study, you know, with deer because of the structure of the retina. You know, they don't see quite as well as us, apparently. You know, like, you always hear 20/20 vision being, you know, kind of the baseline or benchmark that generally you're tested to in an eye exam. Though more acute levels of vision exist, like 20/10, 20/15. I think this is like hearkening back to studying for boards, but I think the physiological limit for a human is like 20 over 6.8 or something like that.
Dang.
But deer, I've read a few different things that, you know, one is probably they see about 2060, so three times worse than us, or 2200, 10 times less acute than us. But their retina is wired to sense movement much better than us, and they process movement like twice as fast as humans do. So they then see it and make sense of it and react to it much faster than we can. Like,
interesting. But the definition isn't there.
Right. It's not as acute.
Interesting.
They wouldn't be able to see the detail, which again, you know, makes me think that a lot of these, you know, camo patterns maybe don't matter that much. It's not to say that that isn't important, but just being still because of their ability to sense movement, you know, is probably, I would suspect, a bigger predictor of being detected or not than, you know, how defined or non-defined, you know, your potential camo pattern is.
Yeah. So Fred Bear was right. The best camouflage is sit still and shut up.
Like, yep.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the best camo for deer. Dude, I really appreciate you taking the time chatting about all of this with me. It was fun, man. Like, we've never gotten this medical on anything, and I love it. Like, now I feel like I need to have more people from that industry on the show and just talk about different things as far as it pertains to hunting. But, yeah, dude, an hour and 20 minutes flew by. I feel like we're 40 minutes in right now. Tops.
We just scratched the surface. There's so much.
We did.
So much more.
We just are going to have to hunt, or you're going to have to come back on and talk about pronghorn and what their eyes look, what their eyes are seeing, and how your hunt went. I'm excited to keep in touch and hear about all that stuff. But dude, before we hop off, where can people find you? Where can, say someone's in Billings, where can they come get their eyes checked and just chat about hunting and what camo to wear?
Yeah. So I am at Billings Clinic. If you're in Billings, you'll know it's the kind of the big hospital system in this part of Montana, extending from the Western Dakotas, Northern Wyoming to Western Montana. I'd love to chat. So come make an appointment and we'll talk things.
There you go. Well, dude, I really appreciate it. Thanks again, and we'll stay in touch.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for the opportunity. This is great.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.